Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and writer, programmer, and curator Carolyn Morissette. In early 1973, her name was Coffee and she'll cream ya. The very next year, she was Foxy Brown. The year after that, she was Sheba Baby, and decades later, she would be Jackie Brown. Pam Grier's career and the title character she's played are vital to movie history. Now, today, we're going to look at two of her lesser discussed but just as important movies, Black Mama, White Mama, and Scream, Blackula, Scream. But before we do that, let's talk a bit about Ms. Grier's work in general. Carolyn, I know you are a fan. You call her my Gemini twin, which I absolutely love. Now, where would you recommend people start with her work? Because it's a pretty wide oeuvre.
Well, yeah, and she is my Gemini twin. Her birthday is a day after mine. And actually, in one of her films, this is, I think it's Sheba Baby. She's like in a hot tub with somebody and she's like, well, you know, I love animals and I'm a Gemini. And I'm like, yes, you are a Gemini. I love you so much. But yeah, if I was thinking about this and I was like, where would I get people to start? So I've got three films. Okay, So I would recommend Coffee because the song.
Sure.
You can't be like that song. Sometimes I would listen to that soundtrack on my way to work. And it would just make me feel like punching people out. But anyway. So,
I gotta say, 1973 is the year of like the best theme songs, yes! Right? Like you have the Exorcist iconic theme song. Sure. We've covered 70s porn here and a number of those pornography films have their own theme songs. Like I cannot, Linda November, man, for the win. I cannot recommend this enough.
Yeah.
Theme like, songs.
Such
Let's
a
get back
great
to it.
Song. Yeah, it's a great song. And I don't know. You know, she's like the queen of vigilantism. Then I would go to, this was a blind spot for me, but I, you know, just kind of watching all her work. Friday Foster's bonkers.
Yeah. Like, and that's getting a re-release now. That's getting updated.
Oh, is it? It's bonkers. Yeah. And like there's a car chase with a hearse. Like,
back end heavy car chase. Yeah, I'm into it. Let's do it.
What? And I know she liked doing her stunts. I'm pretty sure she didn't really, probably didn't drive that hearse, but that's nuts. Like she steals a hearse. And it's so high camp. It's ridiculous.
It's a weird one too. Cause it's a pretty studio movie, even though it's like all the exploitation trapping. So I feel like people don't respect it as much cause it's a little less grimy, but it's fun.
And because Eartha Kitt's in it, then it made me feel like almost like it was an episode of Batman. You know, like it kind of has that studio feel
to
it. Yeah,
it's a comic strip too. I think it was based on a comic book. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah so there's that one, and then I would round it out with Jackie Brown because God, she's so brilliant in that film, and I think that's one like probably my favorite Tarantino film.
I'm with you. Yeah. And although every other Tarantino fanboy would tell us we're wrong because that's everybody's least favorite one, but it's my favorite too.
I think people are coming around to it now, you know, and I think it's the general consensus, right? Even if you don't like Tarantino, Jackie Brown is kind of the one that everyone agrees is good.
It's the one where he's the most well-behaved, I think.
Like, yeah,
where
yes.
He's not a fanboy. He's like this is where he shows that he's a filmmaker and that he can... And, you know, she's an older woman and she's beautiful and there's an older man. Like, it's just like
and Robert Foster are sexy as fuck in that movie. Like, if you want, like, older people chemistry, that is, like, kablamo.
Yeah. I think, and wasn't there was something on the internet where, like, what couple do you wish would have gotten together? And I'm like, those two, you know? Robert Forster and Pam Grier and Jackie Brown. Like, those two I would have loved.
Carolyn, I didn't even realize this. I have a thing where I
love romantic comedies where they don't end up together. Like Timer is one of my favorite things ever. I love ones, and I did not realize that's part of the reason why I love Jackie Brown so much, is because they don't end up together.
Yeah.
Like, spoiler alert if you haven't seen Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
I do have to guiltily say that Jackie Brown actually was my entry point into Pam Grier, because like when that came out is when I was first starting to kind of know. And of course, Tarantino is known for his stunt casting, right? Mm-hmm. So as he was sort of writing it, it was like a Pam Grier type. And hey, what's Pam Grier doing? Let's just cast Pam Grier, right? The history that comes along with Pam Grier when you watch her in that role and everything she's bringing to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For sure. And I think my entry, so I used to be a makeup artist. I used to work at a counter, and I worked with some really crazy gals who are still my friends, like to this day. And one of my friends was like, hey, let's do a remake of a Pam Grier movie. Oh. And so she had it all set out. She's like, you're going to play her. And this is when I was young and spry. And she's like, we'll do it. And because we loved all the iconic photos of her with her fro and like the shirt tied and like, oh, she's just so beautiful and so charismatic. And I think that's when it, and then after that, we were talking about her and I'm like, you know, I think I've only seen like one or two of her movies. So then I started to like, when Suspect Video was open, I would like,
You
know, go get R.I.P. my Pam Grier fix. So yeah.
Well, Cam, do you want to get a little bit into where she kind of originated and how she was discovered? She's got a great Hollywood discovery story.
Yeah, she does. Jack Hill. I mean, I think we're researching 1973, as we talk about, I think a thing I was very interested in was, I guess I always wrote off the blaxploitation era as a bunch of white guys just making money who did not give a shit. And when you hear them talk, it's like, oh, actually, these guys cared. I guess it makes sense that if you're a white guy making a film starring black people, you probably cared a bit about black power and black liberation and these actors. And Jack Hill is somebody like that. He's kind of known as like a weird kingmaker of actors. I didn't realize he discovered Sid Haig, which makes sense in Spider Baby. But he also discovered Ellen Burstyn, which I didn't know. And so he kind of considered himself a guy who likes to look at unknowns. And I guess he had an audition. I think it was for The Big Birdcage. And Pam Grier came in and he immediately was like, this woman is so powerful, I guess is what he said. Like he said she could just command a room and look like she would take no shit in a way that he was like, I love you. And immediately was like, rewrote the film to have a black lead. And then he continued on to be like, I'm going to write movies for you, because I think you're good. And that's Coffee is their movie this year. So yeah, she came, she's kind of an interesting lady who just kind of like, she was at the time very tired of trying to act. She said that she was mostly offered, you know, the usual servant, slave roles, stuff like that. And she was considering going back to school before she got these Filipino exploitation movies, which got her in, I guess. And yeah, and then like we talk about, 1973 was this weird time where it was such a boom in black-led film and studios thinking that they can make money from it, that they started turning to women in the lead, which was fairly unheard of at the time. And she was
especially in these violent action sort of things, which, as you mentioned, Carolyn, earlier, she's doing all of her own stunts. And she has this great quote where she watches herself do it. And everyone's like, is there anything like you're looking back at it now? You're surprised you did. And she's like, I am shocked that I did all of this not wearing a sports bra. Yeah. I have no idea how I managed that. And it is impressive.
Yeah, yes. I also love there's a good Eddie Romero quote where he's like, he liked working with Pam Grier partially because he's like, we'd be setting up a stunt woman jumping off a cliff and she'd come out of her trailer and be like, I could do that, and just did it. And he's like, all right.
Sounds good.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, I don't remember much of that movie, but I remember Pam Grier would just stop every stunt woman and do what they were doing.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of a non-union set. Yeah. Sure, you can jump off the cliff. Go ahead. All right. Well, let's get into our first movie where there's a bunch of cliff jumping and rolling and screaming and sweaty, sweaty human beings. So Black Mama, White Mama is a reworking of the prestige Sidney Poitier, Tony Curtis film, The Defiant Ones. But being about chained prisoners forced to work together is about where the similarity between these two movies end. And that's not a bad thing. Black Mama, White Mama is bananas, pairing together Pam Grier and Margaret Markov for the first time. And it certainly gives famed character actor Sid Haig, dogs, revolutionaries, and drug dealers all the scenery in the world to chew on as they hunt them through the Filipino jungle. Will they escape? Does it matter where there's a scene of them pretending to be nuns? Let's find out. Carolyn, break this one's plot down for us, please.
So we've got Lee and Karen. So Lee is played by Pam Grier, and Karen is played by Margaret Markov. And they're respectively a sex worker and a revolutionary. And they end up in the same jail together in a women's prison. And they basically are put to work in like a plantation there, and they're like chopping and cutting, and like you see the relationships kind of evolve within the jail, and they end up escaping. So once they escape, they try to get to their respective camps, where Lee wants to go get this cachet of money from her drug dealing boyfriend, and Karen wants to go back to her revolutionary group. So they kind of butt heads, and they're chained together, by the way, and they run around with adventures trying to get to their camps. And there's also Sid Haig, who is this ruthless like criminal, and his camp. And there's also, I believe, another drug dealer played by Vic Diaz.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and, so, and Vic Diaz is two of the biggest like scenery chewing villains you can imagine, just trying to like outgross each other.
The movie like briefly just becomes obsessed with the villains, and you're like, where are the ladies? There's like three scenes of just the villains.
I'm actually kind of okay with, because it's that wild. I do have to say, I want to see someone recut this movie with the Benny Hill theme song at once, because I feel like it could really work.
They're running around, and then they finally get loose, and then they kind of come together and become friends. And actually Pam is kind of a final girl in this film as well, so I'm spoiling it, but yeah.
What's great about these movies is they're both pretty readily available, which is really, really nice. This movie also, just here's your content warning, this kind of is like the definition of exploitation. So you've got some sexual assault in here. There's a lot of nudity. There's a lot of language. There's a lot of terrible things happening to women. There's a torture scene. So yeah, that's just your content warning before going into
either of these. He is electrocuting her boobs, though, which I'm like, what is even happening? Is this torture?
Still not as bad as Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS.
No. I will also say, as you guys were saying, this movie has a lot more wacky content than most exploitation. Yeah. Like, it just turns into a silly comedy for like 40 minutes in the middle, which is, I liked it.
Don't they get dressed in, they capture Sid Haig, and then they wear his outfit, and then he's running around in his underwear.
It's fun.
In the Filipino forest, Philippines, and it's pretty
so nuts. This is one of several films that they shot in the Philippines. This is AIP, we should mention. Mm-hmm. So good old Arkoff. Please go back and listen to our episode on Vincent Price if you want to hear his fantastic way of making movies and his formula. Mm-hmm. It's super fun. But this definitely falls into all of this, into his formula. But of course, AIP's mandate was to make movies as cheaply as possible. This is the school where Corman came out of it, as well as shocking as possible. So that's what the exploitation, always taking certain elements. And one of the cheapest places in the world to film was, of course, the Philippines. Now, the movie never actually says they're in the Philippines. No. It's always the island.
Yeah.
But it is very clear they're in the Philippines. I do appreciate they're utilizing a lot of local actors. That's
sure,
nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. And I think that they're kind of pretending that it's South America, maybe. Like, they're pretending it's, like, Spanish. Because I think that's how they get away with Sid Haig being, like, famously a guy that they just got to play every race because he's, like, Armenian. At the time, they were like, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Racially ambiguous. Yeah.
He's got that olive skin. Could be anything.
But yeah, and I think the Filipino accent is like enough that you're like, they're Spanish. It's fine. Yeah. Don't think about it.
The one who killed Paris. I got him right in the neck. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I bet we killed six of them. Maybe more.
Yeah, I found a scholarly paper on basically the exploitation of these films of the Philippines and the people there. And I'm like, wow, like that really went in deep, you know, went in deep because it is, it's cheap labor, it's cheap filming. But then a lot of the actresses, the cast, they were like subjected to like insects and typhoons and like storms and
Pam Grier almost died on this. She ended up with like, it seems like it was malaria or dysentery or something similar. She doesn't know. She just like had a fever of 105.
They don't know. And then she's like, they froze my body to save my brain. It's like, what the hell? Like, it sounded like they put her in a tub of ice until she was better. Which is like, all right. I mean, it worked, but yeah. And I don't
to
know.
Think this is like a remake of the Defiant Ones.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I also love. Yeah, I love that it's like the Defiant Ones is obviously about like racial prejudice, and I love that this movie is just like, nah, they just don't like each other.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, there's not much racial even comes up. It's just like these two ladies kind of dislike each other.
Hey, bitch, I'm talking to you. Look, you had your chance, you didn't want it. So get off my ass.
I think it's that's a weird kind of gender thing where, you know, I think because it's two women and you just kind of assume that women are going to get along, that would be the focal point. Or maybe you just want to see, because that's so prevalent in these women in prison films, you just want to see these women butt heads and have a cat fight. Yeah. And, you know, like you're kind of looking for that. So that's really an interesting thing because, I watched the Defiant Ones and I'm like, wow, this is, race relations 101.
Yeah.
For the time, it was groundbreaking, right? And also,
but now you watch it and you're like, hitting over the head.
Exactly. Exactly. But I mean, these films were groundbreaking too, because it's like women in powerful roles. They're fighting. They're, you know, they're talking back. They're shooting guns.
Yeah.
What do we think the first lesbian shower scene was in a movie that wasn't an actual pornography? Because this certainly has it.
But all these women in prison, there's always a lesbian guard that's creeping. And actually, I read an interesting paper saying that this movie is considered quite feminist, partially because Pam Grier never lets the lesbian guard ever like lay a hand on her. She would rather be like tortured. And then they were saying that, you know, that might be the dynamic, essentially, that she doesn't respect the other woman because she plays along with the guard.
It's such a weird intro to the film because the tone shifts so wildly after they get out of prison. And so from my understanding, Eddie Romero, who's the director, really didn't want any of the skis, any of the like the lesbian stuff, the nude women, any of that. Like, he really didn't want that kind of stuff in the film. But he knew that was like part of the checkbox of Arkoff, of like, you gotta have this, it's a women in prison. So he puts it all, he front loads all of it. So he just gets it all out of the way, all the tropes. And then once they're on the run, he makes the movie he actually wanted to make, which is super wacky.
And I mean, I think he makes interesting dynamics, like the fact that there's not one but two lesbian prison guards, and it seems more like that the dynamic is that the one is kind of the dom who lets the other one do creepy stuff and then like beats up on her, and that's what they're into, more than the one being like a messy it's very weird. But I reading about Eddie Romero is very fascinating, and I think I've only scratched the surface, because it's like he's like one of the founders of the Philippines film industry and is a classy director who, it just seems like when there was exploitation happening, he's like, sure, like I'll take the money and do it. And it seems like he liked to make horror movies, and he did these as like a way to kind of continue. But he has a career both before the exploitation boom and after that is like well respected, you know.
Isn't his family involved in politics? So he was like very highfalutin as well. Like, he was very respected.
Yeah,
very
this
interesting.
This is like co-produced by John Ashley, who starred in some of his movies, and I think is the guy that kind of got AIP across. And he said that, like, I was just reading an interview where John Ashley was talking about how he had a gym, which was quite fancy at the time, but it was gifted to him by Imelda Marcos. So it's like, they were obviously very, very in. And it was interesting. It must be such a strange dynamic. But it seems like the government was into this era as well, supporting it.
I can see that. Well, I mean, again, it's a lot of work for locals. They were using, they had brought over some of their own people, but they also trained a lot of local crews to make their own films there, and kind of Canada, like Australia, like anywhere with a smaller kind of scene, it helps sort of kickstart their film industry.
Yeah, and if you look at, we were talking about Vic Diaz, if you look, it continues for quite a while, too. Like, he's in, like, Philippines-based exploitation movies through, like, the 90s and 2000s. So, as much as there's not the big boom that there is at the start of the 70s, Firecracker is one that recently came out that's like a pornographic kung fu movie, basically, that has been re-released. It's great. I highly recommend it. A lot of it's a real kung fu artist who but her clothes just keep getting ripped off, but it's a great film. But he's in that, and that's like 1981. So yeah, this established an industry that continued at some level or another.
I'm kind of fascinated by this idea of a B-movie hierarchy, which I have to say, until I started like researching 1973, I didn't realize there was one within the performers who did it, specifically the women. And women in prison films were considered like the classiest thing you could do as a woman. Like, because you're doing a bit of softcore porn, but it's not that much. You're usually getting to kick some ass, things like that. So when we were looking at Lady Snowblood, which we'll talk about on the TV show, Meiko Kaji was the same thing. She started out doing like Yakuza pictures and like angry young schoolgirls, and then moved into Women in Prison and then Lady Snowblood. So there's a weird prestige that's associated with this kind of film in the B-movie realm.
I mean, it's a good role for women, right? You got to think of what women were playing in other movies. It's meaty.
So demure, and like, you know, you have to be like a certain way, like the love interest or woman in peril. And I think, you know, just going back to the wardens, the prison wardens, like that's a meaty role in itself,
sure,
to play someone who's horrible and, you know, abusive. And I mean, you're beating up on other women. So that's, you know, I mean, they're not without their problems, but I think it's a great way for women to kind of explore being villains, because, you know, women always have to be the savior or caregivers or whatever. So this
or the victim. Yeah.
The victim. Yeah. So it's nice to see them actually getting into these roles and like showing that women are fallible and flawed and angry and want to kick ass too.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Jonathan Demme, because he is considered like one of the, I guess, the Picasso of the women in prison movies.
Yes.
And this is his first story by credit for any of it. This and Caged Heat would come 2 years later, which is kind of considered his masterpiece of that genre.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people consider it the best, partially because I think in the same way as this movie, it's mostly a prison escape movie. It is not mostly a tortury exploitation movie. It's got a fun escape. But yeah, apparently he sold this one for $500, and at the time it was called Chains of Hate, which is a good, it's got a lot of good alternate titles. In the UK it was called Hot, Hard, and Mean, which I also think is a pretty great title.
Did you see the tagline for this, which I love because it's totally irrelevant? It's chicks in chains ... and nothing in common but the hunger of a thousand nights without a man.
Wow.
Like, rolls off the tongue.
The poster that's on my screen right now says they're choking a guy out, and it says, "Where they come from, this is fun." Which I love. Also doesn't quite make sense. But yeah, Jonathan Demme's an interesting figure. And I mean, he's like John Sayles, where there was all these guys. And actually, you know, even the next writers we'll talk about, they were just selling all these pitches. That's kind of the weird thing. Everybody said you were actually paid pretty well at the time to just sell script and script and script. But, you know, none of them got produced, or Arkoff did something weird with it or whatever. So yeah, it's hard to know how much of this is Demme. But at the time, yeah, he made quite a few AIP movies, I think, before he moved on to be a classier director. It really took till the 80s, I think, before he was doing anything we consider a Jonathan Demme movie particularly.
Oh, one last little thing, Cam, that I want to bring up before we move on is you brought up when we were talking about The Hunger that it's not actually about AIDS, because AIDS came later.
Oh,
it's
sure.
One of those fallacies we have looking back at history. I was like, oh, Karen is Patty Hearst. That's what's happening here. No, Patty Hearst is the following year. Patty
yes.
Hearst is 74. So this is just like, yeah, which I thought that was really interesting, because like, blonde woman joining Revolutionary. She comes from a rich family. Possibly there's some Stockholm syndrome. Nope, not Patty Hearst.
I mean, yeah, that's we find that out more and more that there's just these coincidences. And maybe for all we know that there was a famous woman like Patty Hearst before Patty Hearst. And if you cared about it, it was there. Yeah, it's a very, very confusing cinema history. Nobody knows what's going on is the answer.
Exactly. All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to be looking at, I think it's considered one of the most prestigious performances in a black exploitation movie. We're going to be talking about William Marshall and Scream, Blackula, Scream. That's coming up after the break. Pam Grier's reputation saw her as one of cinema's ultimate tough gals. So who would make a worthy foe? How about 6'5", velvet-voiced William Marshall, a veteran actor known for his portrayal of Othello, including a jazz version that found him opposite Jerry Lee Lewis as Iago. Marshall's Memoirde / Blackula is considered one of the best of the horror-inspired blaxploitation movies, as is its sequel, Scream, Blackula, Scream. But what's so great about the pairing of these two is that although Pam's Lisa Fortier is there to rid the world of Blackula, it becomes so much more than that, given the unique take on the vampire mythos. Let's get into it. Cam, good luck with the, the plot summary here. It's not that bad.
Yeah, there's basically two strands to the plot. What kicks off the plot of Scream, Blackula, Scream does not actually involve him at all. There's essentially this battle for control of a like voodoo group where the Mama Loa has died, and now it's up to a vote. Actually, it's not even like anyone's trying to take control, but Willis, who I believe is her son, believes he's owed it. Everyone in the group is like, no, we vote. And Pam Grier was taken in. She was adopted by the head of I don't know. I don't want to say voodoo cult. It's just a voodoo group. They seem pretty chill. They seem to just do voodoo as a religion, really.
And they just want to hang out and do their thing. Yeah. And Richard Lawson is playing like the greatest vain, like entitled spoiled boy asshole. It's real good. Yeah, but he's having a great time.
They do call it a cult, though. I don't know why they're calling it a cult because they are really chill. They're just like, oh, let's just do our thing.
It seems like honestly, they're probably practicing it just basic religiously. They're not even using the magic particularly. But yeah, she is known to be very powerful with voodoo, and everybody is obviously going to vote for her. So Willis freaks out, leaves. He contacts, you know, a local weirdo who tells him that he can do this ritual over the bones of a ? Figure, and it ends up being the previously killed Blackula has returned, and Willis thinks he'll be able to control him, but he won't. He immediately turns Willis into a vampire, makes him kind of his Renfield, and they live in a big old mansion, you know, that you like, a creaky old mansion. So there's all sorts of mansion antics where basically people get picked off, but along the way he runs into Pam Grier, and suddenly he is very taken by Pam Grier, and Pam Grier also, you know, she like is very interested in African art and stuff like that, and it's kind of slowly comes out that he realizes that she is so powerful in voodoo that she can probably rid him of the curse that Dracula gave him. If you didn't know, he is a vampire because he came to Dracula asking him to stop the slave trade, and Dracula was a jerk and was like, no, you're a vampire now, and cursed him. So he doesn't want to be a vampire either. And he also, maybe he's a little attracted to Pam Grier too. Maybe he's kind of in love with her.
She looks a lot like his wife from the first movie, right? That's part of it.
Yes. And along the way as well, Pam Grier's boyfriend, hanger on, a guy that likes her, I guess, used to be a cop, and he gets involved in the investigation of all these mysterious killings that are happening where people are bitten. Now there's like a vampire hive run by Blackula as well. So it all comes to a head in evil dark house, you know, one of those.
I hadn't seen the original. I've actually, weirdly, I saw Scream, Blackula, Scream first, and then I had to go back and watch Blackula, and I didn't realize the story behind it is that he's actually a tragic figure, which Dracula isn't, even though it's still very sexy, a la vampire, but I didn't know the fact that he's that's a total departure.
Totally. And I think that he has this interesting thing where he is like, he's still the villain. He's still Dracula. He's still biting people. But I think especially because he is motivated by the slave trade, he's this kind of black power person, because he's this very regal person who is disgusted by people who do not, you know, comport themselves well. He beats up some pimps here, and he's like, you've made your sister a slave, and you're slaves too. And you're like, yes, yeah. get him. Yeah. So it's weird because he's bad, but he's, and here actually, I think that they do, it's interesting because we'll talk about it. I think a lot of the creators of the original kind of hate the sequel, but I think that they do a wonderful job of that, making it tragic again at the end. Like, he is bad, but he can't control being bad. Like, he becomes the villain out of his own control, and it's very sad.
And don't we all wish that for our bad boys? Yeah. I can change him. I just need the perfect voodoo magic spell. Yeah. Carolyn, what was your approach to this one? How did you first get into this?
You know, horror noir.
Yes.
That documentary, you know, and Robin Armines Coleman, the author of the original book, from that they made into a documentary. So reading that, and just like in my horror, you know, exploration, mm-hmm. as I grew as a writer, but I didn't really know about Blackula until more recently, like I would say within the last like 5 to 10 years. So that was like a new thing for me. And what kind of blew my mind is in Blackula, I think Gordon Pinsett's in it. He plays like a cop. That's investigating the whole thing. And I'm like, wait, what? This Canadian connection? So I thought that was kind of cool. And I like that he is this tragic figure because he's been made by like this white enslaver, right? Mm. He's been made into this creature, and like, it's a curse. And, you know, it's just really interesting how it kind of parallels to like, say, Ganja and Hess, where that's also another curse. And that's a tragic figure as well. And there's like, you know, black romance involved. Mm. So it's very, for a blaxploitation film, both of them, it's very heady, and you can delve into it. And also, it's what I love, especially with Scream, Blackula Scream, is you showing that the voodoo community is, as we were saying before, really chill. It's a religion. Yeah. They're doing their thing. It's nothing horrific. They're not chopping up animals or whatever.
No.
Although that is a part of it, you know. But and it just shows that black people they know about their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the scene where Blackula comes to this party where Lisa's boyfriend is showing all the African art and jewelry, and he's going to donate it to the museum. And so then they start talking to Blackula, and just seeing everybody dressed to the nines and dancing and just looking like so beautiful and like, it's sad to say, like upper middle class. Like, it's just really cool, you know?
It's true.
It's cool.
Yeah. And I agree that there's that connection to Ganja and Hess here, where it's like it's mostly intellectuals. It's mostly, and I think you see that more and more in blaxploitation. Something like JD's Revenge is all about like an intellectual being warped into a pimp, you know? But yeah, it's cool. And I think that there's all the many more connections. Again, people who are like, this is rewritten to hell. I'm like, it's very, you know, it's very moving that he's, all this talk about African art, I think, is very interesting. And then the fact that his primary thing, even beyond ridding himself of being a vampire, is he wants to go back to Africa, which is like such a part of the movement at the time, the like back to Africa movement, that it's like, this is, it's surprisingly heady. And I would never think, I guess I also forgot that like, it's obviously a terrible title. Calling something Blackula is terrible. Yeah. But then that's addressed in the movie. Like, he's Mama Walde, and Dracula called him Blackula. And then, the like especially tragic moment in this movie is when he like identifies as Blackula. He goes like, I am Blackula, when he's turned completely evil. And you're like, that is like, it is like a weird slave name / real name situation.
Yeah.
Mama Walde.
Name is Blackula!
this is a controversial film and series as well. Like, specifically these two. I mean, there's also, like, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Black, and there's Abby, which is The Exorcist. Blackenstein. Blackenstein is considered the worst of them, apparently. From
and
what
also,
I understand.
Again, a terrible
Carolyn's
name.
Shaking your head.
That one, at least, like, it's, again, not... Yeah, I don't know. It's very weird. I find that most of the horror, maybe JD's Revenge has a little, like, people thought was a little classy, but, like, it's very interesting how that whole part is written off, even though I do think quite a bit of it's good. I think Abby is pretty good. I think, like, the House on Skull Mountain is pretty good. But
I love that movie so much. Yeah. I
explored them, and I was like, these are pretty good. I don't know why they're kind of... But I think it's the stupid titles, a lot of it, to be honest. Yeah.
So a lot of the people who've talked about it and who've written about it were, of course, white men who were seeing that in context that they shouldn't have been seeing it in. So the Scream Blackula Scream won the Golden Turkey Award of one of, like, the worst movies made. And however, it was written by two authors, Michael Medved and Harry Medved, and they admit freely that they chose it as much for the rowdy crowd at the late night Skid Row theater they saw it at as to what was going on. Yeah. So they're judging the audience. They're judging who this is for.
I will also say that I think the Medveds 100% are like, we chose good movies and called them bad movies to piss people off. Like, the Golden Turkey Awards are, I think that they admit more than the Razzies that it's like, we're just pushing your buttons. Because I feel like some of those Golden Turkey books have like a Casablanca on the cover or something, and you're like, what are you talking about? But it's weird. It is weird, and it's interesting that this hasn't, and I think, again, this is where I'm like, I'm surprised that there was so much care taken in these films. And I think, once again, it's also like, when it's a crummy exploitation movie and you have like a performer in it who, like William Marshall, who commands some respect, he's allowed to rewrite stuff, you know? Like, if he's like, I don't like this, you're like, sure, whatever. Like, I don't think Arkoff cares. Like, rewrite it however you want.
Well, there's a great interview with Joan Torres. I don't know if Raymond Koenig is with us anymore because wasn't able to find any interviews with him whatsoever, but Joan Torres still talks about this. She's sometimes miscredited as John Torres, but I think that's people just misreading her name. but she specifically talks about when they went in to write this, they actually did a ton of research on like what voodoo was and like the slave trade and how they could make this work. And they, when they submitted the idea to Arkoff, they were like, we love this, but we need you to black up the language, meaning like make it more jive talky. So they actually called in a friend of theirs who was a very respected artist in the community named Wallace Sides, who, if you look up his, he did the art for the front of the script when they submitted it. And it's real cool.
It's really cool.
Go look this up.
Awesome.
But he rewrote a bunch of the dialogue. And they paid him, and they also pushed to get him screen credit. And he didn't get it for the first one. They wouldn't give him screen credit for the first one, but he did get screen credit for the second one for additional dialogue by, which is awesome that they pushed for that, because they could have just been like, come in, do this, and, you know, look, we did it. And they didn't do that. It was very important for them. They get this stuff right, and they treat it with respect, which I appreciate.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's pretty rare. I mean, even these days, you still see, like, on Twitter, people are like, well, there's no people of color in the writer's room. Nobody's asking us. You know, so I mean, for the time, that's pretty progressive.
Yeah.
Barring them actually have black people write scripts.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, and it's one of those things too that, like, I kind of feel bad for screenwriters when they're trying to write something progressive and you end up in this area where that it's taken out of your hands. So the first victims in the in Blackula are a gay couple, an interracial gay couple, the portrayal of them now is not seen as charitable. It is. Yeah. It's pretty campy and pretty like, oh boy. But the writers were deliberately trying to add in characters you didn't see on film. They wanted to. They're like, we had a lot of friends who were interracial. They were of different sexual orientations, and we wanted to have that in a movie because you didn't see it. So it's just unfortunate that was interpreted in that way.
Yeah. And another great thing I read about AIP, that, because again, AIP mostly did not work with black directors. There wasn't a ton of black directors on their stable. And it was interesting to read about that. Somebody like Jack Hill, I think, was talking about it, and he's like, it was absolutely embarrassing. He's like, as a bunch of white people making these movies, you were embarrassed. And he said that, like, Time magazine wrote about it, and they managed to convince AIP to try to get them more black technicians, because they were just like, so it's interesting, because you're like, you think you're like, well, it was a different time, and he's like, no, it was literally embarrassing on set to be a bunch of white people making these movies. And you're like, oh, okay, that's cool. That I guess you guys were like, you understood, you know.
And wasn't there the scene, I believe it was in Blackula, where they wanted black and white dancers to be dancing intermingled? And yep. somebody was saying, no, we want them separate. You know, like, I guess that's the fight they had.
Yeah.
Where it's trying to make it progressive, but then there's...
Yeah, it's weird. And I mean, you can also appreciate that they're trying to get away with a lot. So I think that sometimes they probably pushed... And probably that's the weird thing that Arkoff knows is, like, if you go this far, it's not going to play in a drive-in in Georgia. But if you, you know, stop at this line, you can get away with it. And whether that's progress or not is kind of, I guess, what's up for debate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, as you mentioned, Cam, this was not exactly what the writers originally intended. So they actually wanted to write about Mamuwalde as Blackula living with his partner from the first movie. The two of them escape and they have a baby. And the movie was going to be about the son of Dracula and he gets called to go deal with voodoo in Haiti. And the final battle is between the son of Blackula and a bunch of zombies,
which I was amazing.
Like, oh, that sounds real fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd watch the crap out of that. So I don't know how that, like, this, I want to be clear. Scream Blackula Scream is a lot of fun. And it, despite what the creators think about it, I think it comes off as what it should come off as. Mm-hmm. But that other version sounds so cool. And I want to see it.
I know. And I will also say that I was a little sad that Joan Torres was so disappointed with the director, Bob Kelgen, because I think it's kind of directed cool. I think that there's some cool sequences, especially when there's like point of view sequences from Mamuwalde. But you can't see him in mirrors, which I'm like, that's a really good trick. That kind of rules. And some of the old Dark House stuff. And I actually one of Arkoff's only things that he comes down with is black people want to see vampires kill cops. So the ending is this vampires versus cops, which I'm like, I mean, who among us does not want to see that? But yeah, I think that end sequence is pretty cool. Like, there's a lot of action going on. It's kind of awesome. And I know that, the director was somebody that apparently Gene Siskel loved, because he's like, finally Blackula gets the Count Yorga treatment, which is like this guy's other movie. And you're like, not a good movie, but apparently Siskel loved it. I don't know. Who knew?
Ebert liked this too, and he specifically praised the William Marshall performance as being akin to Christopher Lee or Vincent Price doing a same kind of thing. However, and this is what I'm curious about, Carolyn, let me know what you think. He criticized it because he's like, I felt they should have gone more into the gothic Hammer horror aspect for more effectiveness. What do you think about that?
No, because, you know, that is Hammer. That's that thing. And then this is, I don't know, I just think it's very specific for the time, you know? Yeah, no, that wouldn't have worked at all. Like, I just think, and it's weird because even though Blackula sticks out like a sore thumb, he commands this respect from everybody immediately, right?
Sure.
So, and
it's
that,
so sexy.
Yeah. And you saying Christopher Lee, I really can equate those two. Like, they both command this respect and there's this awe to the character that I would not want to see the Hammer treatment. I love Hammer films. Don't get me wrong. They're my jam. And like, sometimes, you know, I want to watch something like that on a Saturday afternoon because it just makes me feel like when I was a kid, I found it on TV. I guess because it's so involved with the black culture that to make it gothic would just kind of take away from that. Like, it's just, even though the writers and I know William Crane did the first one, but like, it gives such power to black culture that I think it's perfect the way it is.
Totally.
William Marshall is just such an interesting actor that I don't think we kind of talk about his career enough. Carolyn, do you know much about William Marshall?
No, I don't really know. I know that he was like a stage actor and, you know, obviously in the Blackula films. But I don't really know too much about him. So
he's the stuff that I dug up a little, and Becky, you can probably help me with this. A very fascinating thing that I loved that I think is kind of the Pam Grier thing, too, is apparently it took him a long time to transition from stage to screen. screen because no one would cast him in subservient roles, essentially.
He was too fancy.
And it's just the way he talks. It's like, this guy cannot be your butler. This guy is fancier than you are.
Well, he did play Frederick Douglass in one of the first stage versions of that story on film, which makes sense because that was also a character who had like a lot of regalness to it.
I totally see that. Yeah.
I will also say that for me, it's funny to go back, and I did not realize it was the same guy, but immediately it clicked, is he's the king of cartoons on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yes, he is.
Like, he's the guy that comes and is dressed as a king. There's one different actor, but he's mostly, for most of the seasons, the king of cartoons, which is pretty great. So, like, he was a part of my childhood.
Yeah. Sorry, if you could see my face right now.
No, you'll have to look it up and you'll be delighted because he looks pretty much the same. But yeah, it's very fascinating because I also don't think, like, I think it's easy to be like, oh no, well, his career, he's probably super defined by this movie. But not really, because, like, the next year he won an Emmy, he still continued to play these big roles. The thing that I thought was very interesting and like an interesting link to like the start of the blaxploitation genre is he starred in the original adaptation of Chester Himes' novels that would go on to be Cotton Comes to Harlem, and it was a TV show called Harlem Detective in 1953, but it got canceled because he was called out. He was blacklisted for being a communist. So like he also is a guy who like survived the blacklist.
But what's so impressive about that is that he just said, "Well, fuck it, then I'm going to go back to the stage and play Othello," which is what I'm known
for. It didn't ruin him. He played Othello all over Europe and just came back and then had a second wind. But yeah, and obviously it's very sad because like mid-50s TV, you're not going to find any of it. But apparently there was 12 episodes of this Harlem Detective that is, yeah, Coffin Eddie and all those characters. And it's like, damn, that would be very cool to see.
I actually found an article from the New York Times in the 50s announcing it, referring to its all Negro cast, because of course it did.
Yeah.
But they were actually really praising of like, this is a point of view we have not seen before and we have high hopes for this show.
Sure.
And it was just like, wow, okay.
I mean, it's wild to think because, yeah, I always forget that those Chester Himes novels, because all the adaptations are, you know, 70s and onward. You think of them in the 70s, but yeah, those are 50s, like hard-boiled detective novels. It would have been very cool to see them in that era. And thinking of him, because actually it's interesting, Raymond St. Jacques, who played in Cotton Comes to Harlem, was considered first for the role of Mama Walde. So it's like, oh, I know who you would have played, because it's like the same dude. Yeah, I get it.
I mean, Pam Grier, we haven't really talked about her much so far in this, even though like she does quite a bit. But this is also a gentler role for her. A lot of what she's doing is, you know, she does a lot of the voodoo elements of it. She's not kicking as much ass. It's much more of an intellectual thing. But Carolyn, you were reading a book kind of talking about her as an icon, as a diva, I believe they call her, of the screen.
There's a book by Mia Mass called Divas on Screen, and she looks at a handful of Black actresses and she talks about Dorothy Dandridge, Halle Berry, and she has a chapter on Pam Grier. And it's really fascinating. She breaks it down with the psychology. She comes with receipts. She breaks down Pam Grier's career, and it's really, really interesting. And she calls her, she's got phallic charisma because she's basically, and she actually says it in the chapter, she's ballsy. You know, she plays like really feminine, and she's also got that masculine trait of like, you know, wanting to come in and kick ass and being unafraid, fearlessly going into these roles and playing these characters that are fearless. So I highly recommend grabbing a copy of this book. I actually have a physical and a digital copy. I love it so much. But yeah, it's really fascinating. And it talks about her roles and her like her role in propelling blaxploitation into popular culture and like how she's just so iconic. You know, it's just a really fascinating read.
Did I mention already that Pam Grier apparently has a podcast series coming out where she, I think this fall, where she goes through movie by movie and is going to be talking about, like, it's a tell-all of, like, every single film?
Mm-hmm.
Can't wait. I am so looking forward to it. Oh, man. Yeah, because this is just such a different role for her. It's so demure. Like, the whole film is demure and classy. Yeah.
I totally do think that, interestingly, like, I don't know, not everybody's gonna love, even if you line up Coffee, Black Mama, White Mama, and Scream, Black Yellow Scream, I think you'll have a favorite, and probably some of them you won't like. But I do think it is fascinating to see how Pam Grier plays these different characters. They are very, each one of them is a very different character, which is like a great tribute to her acting, especially at such a young age. She's just a little baby in these movies too. She's a kid.
Yeah. I love it. And it's, I mean, this is really just the start of her gearing up. Like she does, like it's like a 2-3 year period where like she does a lot of the hits where you're like, man, how did you knock out that many movies that are that iconic and that incredible? The fact that she's still making shows and she's managed to find her way into things, even though we're going to be talking about movies like Jawbreaker later on, where like it's, she's definitely not given enough to do in that movie, but she's still great. You know, she shows up. So it, and it's always such a delight when she shows up and it's like, Pam Grier, she's here. Let's go.
What about Ghost of Mars?
Oh, true.
Yes. I love that movie. I actually tried watching it with my boyfriend. He's like, I've seen enough. And I'm like, but it's Ghost of Mars.
It is John Carpenter's Ghost of Mars.
That's true.
Show some respect.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and I love, she's got, on her docket, she has Untitled Pet Cemetery Project, where I'm like, yes, yes, tell me what it is.
I just want to see her fuck up a dead cat.
Yeah,
let's go.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know what's funny? I'm curious because she's such an animal lover. She's a huge animal lover. She's like a horse whisperer, apparently. She has like horses. She's got a
She loves a cowboy hat, so I'm glad to hear that.
No, she's very much a cowgirl. Okay. So I'm curious to see what happens if that is indeed like dead animals coming back.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure she's the, she's got to be the dead is better person, right? She's got to be the don't put things in the pet cemetery.
Exactly.
That's what I would cast her as.
And well, she just doesn't want to be buried in a pet cemetery.
Yeah, there you go.
I get it. All right. Thank you, Ramones. All right. And on that note, we will end this episode. Cameron Maitland, thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you. I also want to shout out my favorite Pam Grier thing. A friend of mine went through cancer and she pointed out that Pam Grier got cancer, stage 4 cancer in the 80s. And like fought it and kind of still is considered in remission to this day. So she had 18 months to live and she's been living for decades. So she says that the wonderful thing is when you're miserable about your cancer treatment, you can just be like, I gotta be like Pam Grier. And like, what a great person to hold in your heart.
Exactly. Oh, that's
no
lovely.
Kidding. Carolyn Morissette, thank you so much for joining us once again, because I know you're very busy because you have a new position.
Yeah, the going hard for Fantasia, programming for Fantasia and Bits. So yeah, thank you very much. I love coming back to talk to you both, and it's so much fun. Thank you so much for having me back.
We have fun talking to you.
Yeah, it's so nice and easy.
And you can join us in 2 weeks where... we've been teasing it since the beginning of the season. We're looking at 70s porn through The Devil and Miss Jones and Wakefield Pool's Bible! ! That's coming up in 2 weeks with Will Sloan and Justin DeClue. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies and the series that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite On Demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. Today's episode featured Cameron Maitland and Carolyn Morissette as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagne. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.